ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Yes, what's it made of anyway? Is it really made of cheese? Could be, does it? Oh, no, hang on. We've been there, haven't we? We've walked on it. It's not made of cheese. Or it could be made of the kind of cheese that I dig out of the back of my fridge sometimes. It's been there for about six months. Anyway, we're in for a treat tonight because across Australia, we are witnessing the biggest, brightest supermoon of the year. The first full moon in November every year is a pretty special moon, but this one is particularly special. It's the closest to us of any of the full moons this year. It's about 221,818 miles from Earth. Believe me, you don't need a telescope or even a dark sky to see it tonight, because a supermoon can seem to be 14% bigger and 30% brighter than other full moons. And just looking up at the sky tonight made me realise just how entranced by the moon we are. I had to be careful because I was driving at the time, but it was pretty special in the windscreen. Across cultures and languages are world over. It's been the subject of countless myths and legends. The Hindu god of the moon, Chandra, associated with the night, plants and vegetation. The Chinese goddess Chang'e, who represents agricultural prosperity, romance and grace. The Incan goddess Mamaquila, wife of the sun god, the moon mother and the regulator of women's menstrual cycles. Some cultures link the moon and its different phases to fertility, the cycle of life. Some associated with specific actions like gaining or losing weight, causing floods, or like people in the Torres Strait, using its phases for navigation and legal claims. And there's all the folklore and myths associated with the moon, as werewolves, the man on the moon, full moon fever. Does it really have a connection with human behaviour? Could we survive without the moon? What's it made of? We're going to fuel our curiosity further and talk about all things moon tonight with our guest, but if you've got a burning question about the moon, 1-300-800-222. Lines are free. 1-300-800-222 is the number to call on if you want to send us a text or maybe a photo you took of the supermoon tonight, 0467-922-702. Let's introduce Associate Professor Alice Gorman. Alice is a space archaeologist. How about that for a job? At Flinders University, and she joins us this evening. Alice, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks for having me on, Phil.
Yes. In the Northern Hemisphere, they call it a beaver moon because apparently that's because beavers can build dams all night as well as during the day. So that's all right, but we wouldn't call that here. But I don't think that we have a name for this moon, a universally agreed name, do we, Alice? I mean, I presume Indigenous people had a name for it, but given there are so many cultures and traditions there, we probably can't agree on it either. What do you guys call it? My
perception, Phil, is that it's only really in the last few years that we've had a bit of an obsession with naming every kind of full moon or supermoon that comes up. And as you pointed out before, I mean, there's lots of different traditions in different parts of the world. But we used to have, we'd have the blue moon, and then we had the blood moon, which we all remember, you know, when the moon appears very pink or red, especially when it's close to the horizon, but higher up as well. And we seem to have got a little bit obsessed with naming every one of these moons, which is why I think people have been saying, you know, trying to foist the concept of the beaver moon on parts of the world which have no beavers.
We have no beavers, that's right.
So I don't think we actually need to have a name for every one of these occasions. And, you know, it is memorable because you can go outside, or you could. It's cloudy in South Australia tonight where I'm joining you from. You can go outside and spend some beautiful moments communing with the moon, which brings us, you know, life and light and joy, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. But I don't think we need to get overly excited about having
heavens,
a name.
Heavens above, Alice. Here there is. I mean, what are you doing giving us a torrent of common sense? I'm glad you said that because this beaver movement thing was driving me nuts all day. I was thinking, why are we calling it this? There are no beavers here in Australia. What is it anyway? I mean, I understand this is the closest the moon will be this year. Is that right?
I think that is correct. So basically the idea of a supermoon is when the full moon coincides with the moon's closest approach to Earth. Hmm. So you get, it's already looking much bigger because it's full, but it's also a bit closer to Earth. And you know, you might, that it's called perigee, that closest approach, and you might have it when the moon is new or when the moon is a quarter full. So when it coincides with the full moon, we get a moon that appears much bigger, and there's this weird effect. I mean, you can see it if you go outside at any point. There's also this effect if you look at the moon close to the horizon. For some weird atmospheric reason, it looks even bigger than that. So you have this sensation that the moon is you know, well, not exactly going to come crashing down on Earth, but you really get a sense of the presence of the moon.
Mm. Yeah, Roy from Glenroy. G'day, Roy.
G'day, Phil. How are you?
Pretty good.
My question
is
just to get an idea of the comparison between the size of the Earth and the moon, if it was possible... If we consider that Uluru is in the centre of the continent of Australia, if you could balance the moon on Uluru, where would the extremities of it be? Just to give us an idea of, like, would it be shading over Africa and, you know, taking all the Pacific and all the Indian Ocean, or where would it? How big is it in that regard?
How big is the moon, Alice?
That's a very visual image you've just given us.
Well, that's how I think.
I love it. And I think I don't have the kilometre figure of the moon's diameter off the top of my head, but if you think of the fact that Pluto is, you know, sort of planet-sized, and Pluto would fit inside Australia, I'm pretty sure the moon is smaller than that. So it's probably... Well, but now that I've said that, in fact, Pluto could be smaller than the moon. I think we better do some quick Googling on this.
Right.
Okay, but I mean, if it was balancing on the top of Uluru, Roy, the answer is it's probably going to be, what, a little bit bigger than Australia, that's it.
So
I think,
You reckon it would just pretty much run from coast to coast?
So the diameter of the moon is 3,500 kilometres.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think that is the case.
Hmm.
Yeah, fair enough, Sam. Thank you for that. Hey, and thank you for saying kilometres and using the word diameter too. Appreciate both of those.
On your Roy. On your Roy.
No worries.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-300-800-222 is now. What's it made of, Alice? Is it made of the same stuff as the Earth?
Yeah, kind of, but it's... I don't want to say simpler, but it is probably geologically a little bit simpler than Earth. So there is an iron core, which is pretty similar to us.
Hmm.
Then you have a liquid layer around that, again, pretty similar to us. And then you have a mantle and a crust, and there's a lot of basalts, pyroxenes, olivines, and orthosites, which is a mineral that's not actually all that common in Earth.
Hmm.
So a lot of those more complex minerals, maybe we don't have quite so much of those on the moon. So basically we've got a lot of iron in the center, then a lot of sort of volcanic kind of rocks that fill up the mantle and the surface.
Mm, okay. All right, gee, thanks for the photo to the moon, everyone. A beautiful one from Maroubra Beach tonight coming in. Susan from Cleveland in Queensland sent us a lovely one. The one from the Miners Memorial in Broken Hill, beautiful picture of the moon. Apparently the moon's very visible from the Adelaide Hills, Alice, so pity about where you are. But
down on the flat.
You are in the flat, yeah, exactly, but clearly visible. And Dalesford in Victoria, as well. So if it's made of roughly the same stuff, is there an agreed theory about where it came from? Is it a bit of the Earth that got broken off, or is it not?
There's a few competing theories, but the sort of dominant one is that a planet-sized object called Theia collided with the Earth, you know, really early in its history, when the Earth was only about 100 million years old, and it split the Moon off, from, and the Earth at the that Earth. Stage was
from the Earth, yeah.
From the Earth, but both the Earth and the Moon incorporated some of this planet Theia into them. The planet broke up on the impact. And there's an interesting theory, because everybody wonders where Earth's water comes from. Like, we don't actually really know. And one theory is that this planet Theia actually brought a lot of the water to Earth and the Moon. So the Earth's all molten at this stage, and the Moon breaks off and is also molten, and parts of Theia get incorporated into the Moon and to Earth. But then Earth it's much bigger. It undergoes much more complex sort of mineralogical development, and the Moon is sort of left at that slightly simpler stage, I guess you could say.
Okay, so what? So this planet Theia was totally absorbed into the Moon and Earth on collision, was it?
Yes, so the planet no longer exists, which is what makes it sort of hard to, you know, definitively say what was the origins of the Moon. We're looking back, you know, 4.5 billion years ago. It's a long time ago. The thing I find really interesting about this is, you know, we have this kind of idea of the planets running around the sun like clockwork, you know, on their little orbits, troof along, and the Moon's going around the Earth in the same sort of clockwork way. But the solar system is not actually a stable place. There have been times in its history when there's been things flying around all over the place, like this planet Theia, and things, you know, sort of settled down, but it could happen again. It's not impossible that, you know, we might have a rogue planet come through. Its orbit becomes unstable, and then suddenly all bets are off. So it's interesting to contemplate the solar system as a really violent, dynamic place, and not as this very
orderly,
stable place.
Orderly thing where stuff spinning around other stuff, and nothing ever changes. Yes, it's more of a progressive barn dance, perhaps, than a waltz. Barry from Tennant Creek. G'day, Barry.
Good evening. It's a two-part question. One, there is no dark side of the Moon, as we only see one face of the Moon as it is constantly falling towards us. And it does not circle the Earth. It follows us in a corkscrew fashion as we're moving towards the sun, and the sun is moving to galactic central point on the Milky Way. So it's a corkscrew fashion. It is not circular motion around the planet Earth.
Yeah, Alice?
Very interesting point. So, first of all, that's quite true. We sort of say the dark side of the Moon, but it's the far side of the Moon. It has day and night, just like we do, just like the rest of the Moon does. It's just that we can't see it.
We can't see it. And that's your point, Barry, isn't it? That's right. It's not dark. It's just that we can't see it.
Corkscrew orbit, that's a different, really interesting question. So orbits are elliptical, they're not circular, but I think you're getting this corkscrew thing from quite a well-known diagram that someone made of Earth and the other planets as they're moving through the galaxy. So when you factor in the movement of Earth itself, things orbiting it are sort of corkscrewing around it as Earth travels upwards. But this diagram has been very severely criticised as misrepresenting what actually happens. Mm. Now, Barry, don't ask me how I would represent that because I don't know, but I just wanted to let you know that corkscrew motion is not considered to be an accurate description of the way that planets move through the galaxy.
Mm. Okay.
But the Earth is moving.
Oh, definitely, absolutely, definitely. And there's, in fact, in relation to the moon, a colleague of mine did this fascinating study where, because, of course, we've got atmosphere and trees and water and rain and clouds, but the moon has no atmosphere. So everything that happens in the solar system around it is recorded on its surface, all of the different cosmic particles that impact the surface, all the meteorites from different places, it's all written there on the surface. And as Earth itself has moved through the galaxy and the galaxy is also slowly rotating, the moon has evidence of all of the different parts of the galaxy that our solar system has moved through over 4.6 billion years. So this makes the surface of the moon a precious record of this thing we can't see on Earth, and all the more reason why we should take good care of it.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Our guest is Alice Gorman. Alice is a space archaeologist at Flinders University, and we're answering questions about the moon. Plenty of people are saying, what are you going on about? The moon is made of cheese. Well, I'm kind of with you on that. But we don't have much evidence for our theory, that's all. Gus from Maruya, hello.
Yeah, g'day. I'm on the road heading towards Maruya at the moment and looking at it. It's right in front of me.
Oh, what's it like? It must be beautiful, is it? Yeah.
It's huge. There's nothing obstructing the view. It's like it's just there for me. It's wonderful.
Yeah, fantastic. Good on you. I'm glad you're in the car looking at something other than your phone, Gus.
So my query is, there's this history of ideas of the moon being made out of other stuff, cheese or whatever. And I'm just wondering, when did we find out what it's really made out of? And then part of the reason I ask is that in my head, I've still got the jingle from Dr. Doolittle as a kid with Brett Saracen telling us that, my friend the doctor says that, the stars are made of lemon drops, the bigger ones are lollipops, and...
Yeah.
These sorts of ideas are brilliant. They're beautiful. But when did we really find out what it's made out of and how?
Okay. Alice, when we landed there? I know we'd sent probes to the moon before. Or can we find out by pointing things at it from the Earth?
It's much... we found different things out about the moon at different times. Mm-hmm. So we found out it had no atmosphere, I don't know, probably mid-1800s. I mean... Once you start to get good telescopes, which, of course, were invented by Galileo in the 1600s, start to see things. And it was originally thought that the moon was a smooth body, like smooth like a rubber ball, and all the markings you see on it were surface markings. They didn't represent different mountains and valleys and things like that. The recognition that the moon was a rocky body like the Earth, I think, was starting to filter through in the 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a while for people to confirm, there's really no atmosphere. Then, of course, it's not just optical telescopes. You can send radio signals to the moon. You can analyze the light that the moon sends back. So the chemical composition of the moon would probably only have been kind of fine-tuned, I think, at the same time we learnt the chemical composition of the rest of the things in the universe. So it used to be thought that the sun was made of rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably in the earlier part of the 20th century that we started to get a handle on things as we now know them. And, of course, when the first satellites and spacecraft went to the moon, brought back data, so we're talking 1950s. By then we knew it was probably volcanic rocks. There were theories in the 1800s that the moon surface was formed by really active volcanoes that may still be working, which of course they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose it's sort of a gradual building up of knowledge, but that the general idea that the moon was a rocky body and that it had some similarity to Earth would have been mid-1800s, I think.
Okay. We know because we've brought moon rocks back, haven't we?
Kilograms and kilograms of them, us and Russia. So we've had the opportunity to analyze them. And, of course, it's the tiniest sample of the whole moon, but they targeted, you know, the Mare, the lunar seas, the lunar highlands. The last Apollo mission, Apollo 17, they sent a geologist. Thank heavens, they sent a geologist along who actually knew what he was looking at and could bring back good stuff.
They say it smells like gunpowder. Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of space things smell a bit like gunpowder, and some of that is ozone, which has a very distinct smell. And, of course, the astronauts never could take their helmets off to smell it firsthand, but moon dust got into everything. So that they brought back a in fact, the dust buster was invented for the Apollo 14 mission so they could vacuum up the dust inside their spacecraft. Okay. So they brought it home with them. They brought this smell, this very distinct smell, home with them, with the moon dust.
Do we know why it smells like that?
I'm sure there's a very good reason, which a planetary geochemist could tell us.
Hey, tell me about the water on the moon. There is, contrary to what we believe for a long time, there is water on the moon. When we say there is water on the moon, where is it and how much of it is there?
We've learned so much about the moon with recent missions. So it was suspected that deep craters in the South Pole and the North Pole might have trapped volatiles like water in them and kept them there as ice. So that was suspected since the 1950s. And Mercury too has craters like this. But it wasn't confirmed until, I think, 2009, the Chandrayaan-3 Indian orbiter sent back data which suggested that there was water ice in these really deep craters. And ever since then, we've been getting more and more data, and it seems to be confirmed there's water ice. They call them the permanently shadowed regions. And it's some of the coldest places in the solar system.
Really? Okay. Well, so I was going to say, my question was going to be, why doesn't it just evaporate into the vacuum of space? But the answer is because
it's ice. It's permanently shadowed. It's so much ice. But there is water that evaporates. So the moon has water cycles that we don't yet fully understand. So away from those polar regions, little tiny bits of water form and they form when it gets cold and they melt again when it becomes day, and the oxygen and the hydrogen are constantly sort of being renewed.
Really?
So, yeah, and this is on the...
The moon has water vapour?
Well, yeah, I guess it would be not enough for any kind of atmosphere, and it freezes again, you know, as soon as it gets cold enough. But there is water ice being formed constantly in daylight in other regions. So many complex things going on with the moon.
1-300-800-222 is the number if you would like to give us a call. Thank you, Paul in Perth, with a beautiful picture of the supermoon tonight. This supermoon, which Latif says, why is it called a beaver moon? We don't call it a beaver moon, Latif. It's called that in America, but we don't have any beavers here, so we could think of an Australian name if you like. I don't know. Someone said the grain moon or the witchetty grub moon. Why not?
Ooh, I quite like that.
Yeah. There would have been indigenous names for it, but then again, there are lots of indigenous language groups all around the country, so heaven knows. I don't think there was probably an agreed name for it. Dawn from Sunbury, hello.
Hello, this is Dawn.
Yes, hi, Dawn.
Alice and Phil.
Hi, Dawn.
Hi.
I know there's a correlation between the phases of the moon and the tides.
Mm-hmm.
So because the moon's so much closer, does that mean we can expect king tides and tsunamis because it might affect the oceans? Is that any sense in that?
Well, fortunately, we won't expect any tsunamis. And I've got to confess, the lunar motion and its relationship to different kinds of tides is science that's out of my area of expertise. But as I understand it, I don't think especially, as far as I know, I mean, certainly we do get higher tides, king tides and things at different parts of the year. The thing about this is it's the full moon when it's at its closest to Earth, and the moon revolves around the Earth every month. So this would happen at many times that don't coincide with the full moon. But we would probably need some tidal scientists or some oceanographers to tell us the impacts it would have. But I haven't seen any predictions, you know, saying, you know, keep away from the coast.
No. One other little question. I know gardeners think about the moon when they're planting seeds and plants out, because I guess it's just more light. I think there's a connection between the moon and gardening. Do you ever have questions about that?
Alice?
I, at one point, Dawn, and you might like this, I researched how you would create a moon garden where all of the plants flowered at night or released their fragrance at night and under the full moon. And, of course, I never made it because I haven't had a garden for years. But I love the idea that the moon would and there are flowers that come out under the light of the moon and not in daytime. And I know that there is a lot of gardening lore which correlates planting different things to the lunar phases. And we know the moon has a huge influence on insect life, on animals, on plants, so it wouldn't surprise me at all.
All right, thanks, Dawn. That's not a bad idea, John. John of Coburg says the full moon in November would have to be the Melbourne Cup moon. Alice is not. Alice, my guess, is not in favour of coming up with these names, but we can do it.
I don't mind coming
she's
up with
a,
some.
She's not cranky about it. Yeah, she's not cranky about it. Could have been met. Oh, yeah, the Melbourne Cup moon. That mightn't make everyone in Australia happy, John. I know you might be in Victoria, but they'd be saying, hey, what do you mean Melbourne Cup? Get off. It's not, yes, facts about the moon. We don't know. We know there's water there. We don't know how much, though, do we? And we don't know whether there's any more in the crust of the moon, do we? Or do we?
Well, we actually do because people have calculated the percentage. Well, there's a couple of things. There's oxygen and hydrogen, which, of course, you need to make water, and plenty of them in the crust of the moon. There's actual water, the molecule H2O, and then you have the free water, water in a body, a lake of ice or a little half moon in the lunar soil. And one calculation was that there was enough water to keep, I forget what it was, let's just hypothetically say 100,000 people alive for 100 years.
Really?
So this is not insubstantial. This is okay. Something, if you knew how to actually extract it
and keep it in a closed cycle, perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it could potentially allow permanent habitation on the moon.
If that's a good idea, and I don't know why it would be, but there you go. Graham from Karrinyup. G'day, Graham.
G'day, Phil. G'day, Alice. My question, Alice, is you've just been selected by SpaceX to go to the moon, so what would you actually do in your exploration?
Good question.
Well, that is a very good question. I would have a very specific thing that I'd like to explore as a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
SpaceX might not be enthralled with this. You know when you see pictures of them, like we look at moon from Earth and it's iridescent, it's glowing, it's luminous, but then you see photographs of the lunar surface and they're grey and black and white and they appear to Earth sensibilities to be boring. I didn't mean to say boring, but I suppose people think they're not that exciting compared to all the green and blue on Earth. And I think this is partially a function of human eyes. So if you think about animals like dogs, for example, and nocturnal animals, they have more rods in their eyes and fewer cones. We have more cones and fewer rods. We see in colour, but a lot of animals that are nocturnal apparently see in black and white, which isn't a bad thing for them. Their eyes are structured completely differently. How would the moon's surface appear to different kinds of eye? This is something that I would find a really fascinating research project.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because, Graham, when you look at the pictures sent back from Mars, for example, Mars looks a lot more colourful than pictures from the moon, don't they?
Well, I'm legally blind and I have problems with my rods and cones, yeah. So she's answered something very...
Yeah, we're asking the wrong person here.
No, we're asking the right person because I think it would be really interesting to get your reactions to the amount of colour and light and dark on the lunar surface.
Right. Well, thank you for
Thanks, Graham. But that is a point, though, isn't it? That why does the moon look so grey and Mars look so red?
You know, on the Apollo 12 mission, which was Apollo... The Apollo 11 mission was July 1969. Apollo 12 was December 1969, same year. One of the astronauts who went on Apollo 12 was an amateur artist. And when he came back from the moon, he started painting the moon. And he didn't paint it in grayscale or black and white. Mm-hmm. He painted it with mauves and yellows, and it was a distinct palette. It was colorful. And he said you just had to be alive to the colour. You would see colour everywhere if you were looking for it. And all right, it's not the red sands of Mars, but the moon has more colour in it than we know. We've seen it from orbiting spacecraft and we've seen those very few locations where spacecraft with cameras or humans with cameras have been. There's a place on the moon which has orange soil. They found it in the highlands in Apollo 17. So maybe there's much more colour going on than we know about right now.
Why is everyone racing to go there? Looks like a... Buzz Aldrin, when he stepped out onto the lunar surface, described it as magnificent desolation.
He did, like the high country of the southern states of the US. My theory... Or the evidence suggests to me that the reason everybody is falling over themselves to go to the moon is for reasons, firstly, of national prestige. So it's a bit of a Cold War competitive thing. Everybody, every nation wants to have a successful lunar mission. But the real reason, I believe, so is that when the first nation makes a territorial claim on the moon, and I think it's probably likely to be the US, everyone, if you're not on the moon by then, you've got no chance. So you have to have something on the surface of the moon. You have to do your best to have spacecraft there, maybe have astronauts or crew there, because when a major spacefaring nation says, right, the treaties are out the window, we're going to claim the moon as ours, you have to be there on the ground or you'll never have a chance.
There isn't at the moment, is there? I remember we spoke to the philosopher A.C. Grayling a year or so ago about who owns the moon, and the answer is, well, no one, it seems. He compared it to Antarctica, which is governed by a treaty, which is quite specific, and says we ought to have such a thing for the moon as well.
It would probably be a good idea. So at the moment we have the Outer Space Treaty, which says that no one can own the moon. We also have the Moon Agreement of 1979, which strongly emphasises that point, no one can own the moon. Nations are choosing to interpret these treaties as if you extract a mineral from the moon, you can own that. So you could argue that the treaties don't technically allow that, but everyone has agreed that that will be allowed. So for the moment, everyone is holding to the treaties, holding to that idea that no one can own the moon. All we need is for one nation to say, I'm claiming this as US land or Australian land or whatever, and everybody else will have to follow suit.
They better get there soon, because apparently the moon is moving away from the Earth at a sure and steady rate.
This is true. Mm. So the thing that fascinates me about this fact is that this means in the past the moon was much, much closer to the Earth. So about 3 billion years ago, the moon appeared 30% bigger than it does now. But it's a very small movement. It's 3.8 centimetres a year, and it makes the day like 0.1 of a millisecond longer. So it's going to take quite a lot of years before it even adds a second to the length of the day. And probably we won't really see the difference that much either.
I guess not. Not before our species has successfully immolated itself, I presume.
Well, just to add a cheery note to this, Phil,
1-300-800-222. Associate Professor Alice Gorman's with us, space archaeologist at Flinders University, on this night when the biggest and brightest supermoon of the year, the November full moon. It's the closest it'll be this year. We're talking about the moon and asking questions about it, if you've got one. 1-300-800-222. Richard from Reservoir. G'day, Richard.
Yeah, hi, how are you going? I was just listening in relation to there not being a dark side of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were, I can't explain it, but if you were on the edge walking along the moon and the sun was there and then you went to the other side, wouldn't that be dark?
Only if it was nighttime, Richard. So yeah, there's like, still night.
It's only dark for us, Richard, because it's the far side of the moon and we never get to see it.
So the moon is still moving around the sun in the same way. Like we move around the sun, we're turning on our axis, so we get day and night in 12 hours. The moon similarly turns different sides to the sun, so it has days and nights that are fortnight long each. So a lunar, it's a very it's and I would love to be able to explain it in a simple way, but it's actually far more complex than it sounds.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, what I was thinking, if you're sitting on the beach and you watch the sun go down, and it disappears. Would that not be the same if you were sitting on the moon and one side would be dark and the other side would be bright?
Yes, except that won't coincide with what we call the far side every time. But if you sat on a nice little lunar beach and waited a fortnight for the terminator, the dividing line between night and day, to pass over you, you would go from being in daytime into darkness. We've got the atmosphere that softens that appearance, but on the moon with no atmosphere, it'll be 1 minute it will be sunshine and the next minute it will be absolutely pitch black and it will get cold very, very quickly. So go and put your jumper on, quick sticks.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating.
Thank you, Richard.
I still can't quite comprehend it. Thank you.
Wild.
I know. Space, what was it Elon Musk said about space? He said space is hard. It is. Space is, yes, it is. Just get this into this is the thing about space that I always found difficult. It says when your rocket blasts off from Earth, it is always falling. I thought, hello? How does that work? You have to think about it, but it's apparently right. Robin says, OMG, I want to enrol in this wonderful woman's class. Fabulous segment.
That's lovely, Robin.
Alice Gorman is with us, a space archaeologist. How can you be a space archaeologist, Alice? What do you dig up? Archaeologists dig things up.
Sometimes they dig things up. They spend a lot of time doing surveys on the surface, just walking over the landscape and identifying archaeological remains or heritage remains. So to do space archaeology, I'm looking at everything from everything from the Second World War, which is when we developed the first rocket capable of going to space, onwards. So rocket launch sites, antennas and tracking stations, then through to all of the space junk in Earth orbit, all of the sites on the moon, sites on Mars, Venus, one on Mercury, places throughout the solar system. So I'm interested in the artifacts, the objects, and the places themselves and what they tell us about human culture. And I've also done a big project on the International Space Station, which turns 25 this month, has just turned 25. So using objects to try and work out how to design better space stations. So that's a practical application for archaeology.
Mm. Well, actually, archaeology on the moon would be very good, I would imagine, because there's no weather, so nothing ever gets degraded. So everything that's been to the moon is still there, isn't it?
Well, the moon kind of does have weather.
Really? Okay. All right. What sort of weather? What do you mean the moon has weather? What sort of weather? There's no atmosphere. How can it have weather?
This is a really good point. The moon has an exosphere. It's like really, really thin, barely there atmosphere at all.
Mm.
But what happens on the moon, it undergoes a process called impact gardening. So for our gardener, Dawn, who called before, impact gardening is when the surface gets regularly turned over by the impact of meteorites, solar flares. Just imagine the sunlight on the moon, no atmosphere to protect you. The sun, it's really the sun. There's cosmic rays, there's gamma rays, there's every bit of the moon is bombarded by micrometeorites all of the time. And this is Australian research, actually, there was a Western Australian scientist called Brian O'Brien, and he was working at Rice University in the US in the 1960s. And he designed a little dust detecting experiment that was sent to the moon on four of the Apollo missions. And what he discovered was when that terminator, the dividing line between day and night, passes over the ground, it makes all of the dust turn into little mini storms because the dust is electrically charged. So you've got this sort of weather system formed from the impact gardening, from the electrical charge, and from the effects of sunlight and all of these rays on the surface. So the surface moves around a lot, and different parts of the moon get different kinds of weather depending on where the sun is and all of this. So unfortunately, a lot of the artifacts humans have left there and even the footprints might not last as long as we hope they would.
Mm-hmm. All right, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Greg in Glenelg in South Australia. Hi, Greg. Down at the beach there, it'd be lovely to. Can you see the moon from there?
Oh, yeah. I was just out in the backyard with the kids looking at it. It was just beautiful, fantastic. Yeah.
Wow.
I got a question. I'm just wondering, what would the Earth be like without a moon?
How would it affect us?
What would that mean for the Earth? And just my second question, I just wanted to ask was. What does she feel about all the conspiracy theories of no one's actually been to the moon?
not hard questions at all there. I think your first one, what would it be like without the moon, is really interesting. So the first thing I think of is if we didn't have any big light in the sky, every night would be equally dark all the time. And that, to me, I think is sad. It's sad to think of a hypothetical world where no one has the moon. The second thing is, of course, tides wouldn't operate.
No.
So it's quite likely that the water would be a lot flatter, would cover more of the land surface because it's not constantly being drawn up and let go again. There are so many, like the seas are such a dynamic place because we have these tidal zones and the water moves. So everything would be like wildlife or flora and fauna would grow at a certain depth and temperature. And that's what it would be like all the time. It wouldn't change with the tides. It wouldn't be this dynamic system. The seas would be, well, what would storms be like without the tides?
Mm.
I'm trying to imagine that. I don't really know how to imagine that. Without the moon, we have all these nocturnal animals that hunt by the light of the moon. Humans use the light of the moon to do things like hunting and gathering as well. So navigating, there'd be no moon to navigate by. Of course, when it's a new moon, you don't have that anyway, but you know it's coming back. So I think we'd have a really, life on Earth would be really different. It would have evolved in different kinds of ecological contexts. We might not have migration of insect, bird, animal species in the same way that we do. We may not, well, some people say that when the planet Theia collided with Earth, it kick-started the process for developing life. I don't have an opinion on that. I don't know enough about it. But but without the moon, we'd be looking at a very different place.
We would. We would. Well, go outside and have a look at it. It is quite remarkable. The moon is moving higher. I'm starting to get vertigo watching it, says my texter.
Oh, but we missed the conspiracy theory part of Greg's question.
I've skipped over it. We've only got a few seconds left, but
conspiracy theorists will never let the truth get in the way.
No.
That's all I can say about that.
Exactly right. Yes, you can see with the telescope that there are people that have landed on the moon, so just all right, Alice, it's been terrific. I mean, this hour has whizzed by. That's an hour we could have been spent watching at the moon too. So if you haven't looked at it tonight, have a look at it. Associate Professor Alice Gorman is a space archaeologist at Flinders University and has been our guest tonight. Thank you, Alice.
Thank you, Phil. A terrific lunar discussion.
It was good fun. As I say, enjoy, feast on the moon.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.